This is The Record. I'm Steve Scherr. Nick Turse opens his book about America's Vietnam War, recounting a veteran's letter to President Richard Nixon in 1971. Quote, "Maybe your advisors haven't clued you in, but the atrocities that were committed in My Lai are eclipsed by similar American actions throughout the country." Nick Turse has written a detailed account of the widespread killings that occurred during that war. It's called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
How'd you come to write this book? You're a younger man. This was not your war.
Yeah, I really stumbled upon this project. I never set out to write a history of American war crimes and Vietnamese civilian suffering, but I was working as a graduate student on a project on post-traumatic stress disorder among Vietnam veterans. And I would head down to the National Archives to find hard data to match up to interview material that we had. And on one of these trips, every research avenue that I tried was a dead end. I just hit one brick wall after another. And finally, on my last day at the archives, I went to an archivist that I worked with and I said, "Look, I can't go back to my boss empty-handed. I need something, at least a lead, or he's never going to send me back down here again." And he asked me a question that ended up changing my life. He said, "Do you think that witnessing war crimes could cause post-traumatic stress?" And I told him, "You know, that's an excellent hypothesis. What do you have on war crimes?" And he told me about a group of files called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group records. And I asked him to pull those records for me. And within an hour, I was paging through about 30 boxes filled with the Army's own investigations of massacres, murder, rape, torture, assault, mutilation, horrific crimes that were reported by active duty GIs and recently returned veterans and investigated by the Army's own criminal investigators.
You wrote, "But as I came to see the indiscriminate killing of South Vietnamese noncombatants, the endless slaughter that wiped out civilians day after day, month after month, year after year throughout the Vietnam War was neither accidental nor unforeseeable." Not accidental, an operation, not an aberration?
Yes, that's the way that Ron Reidenauer put it. He was a whistleblower who, his allegations led to the investigation of the My Lai massacre. And it, as I looked over these records, I realized that they showed systematic atrocities and systematic killing of civilians, that this wasn't an aberration, it wasn't bad apples. And I spent 10 years researching this project in the U.S. and Vietnam, going through the Pentagon's own records, and it became clear to me that the killing of civilians was a matter of command policy. It was not something that occurred because of the troops on the ground. It was coming from the Pentagon on down.
Command policy to commit war crimes?
Well, I should say that most Vietnamese weren't killed in My Lai-style massacres. Micro-level war crimes like massacres and murders killed many Vietnamese, but the predominant number were killed through the application of heavy firepower, through bombing, artillery shelling, helicopter gunships, and this is what stemmed from command policy. The U.S. Military made it policy to unleash heavy firepower on the countryside where the civilians lived.
Kill anything that moves.
Yeah, it's a phrase that I originally found in one particular war crimes case, a massacre that was heavily investigated by the Army, and the claims were corroborated. And then I noticed again and again that this phrase came up in case after case, that it became a standing order in Vietnam in many units. And I noticed that it was used many times in many places over the years, that this was a de facto order that was put out there.
Nick Turse is a journalist. He's written Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. The Army investigated it. Did they see what they had done as war crimes themselves?
Well, this war crimes working group that amassed all these records, they definitely realized that these were, at least the micro-level things, were crimes. When I talk about systemic things, policy, certainly not. The military came up with lots of legal fictions to justify the application of heavy firepower on heavily populated civilian areas. While the rules of engagement were actually impeccable on paper, they were laden with loopholes, and the military made it easy to kill civilians that way.
You talked to veterans in writing this book. I want to talk about what those veterans' goals were and what your goals were. But, you know, you mentioned My Lai. I bet there are many people who, though you said people may know about it, and that was what they point to when they talk about war crimes or atrocities in the Vietnam War. A lot of people may not know what happened in My Lai.
Right. It occurred on March 16th, 1968. Elements of the 23rd Infantry Division, called the AmeriCal, they landed in a small village, a hamlet, called My Lai, and over a period of 4 hours, they proceeded to kill more than 500 civilians there. They also raped women, burned down the village, fouled the water, mutilated bodies. And this stayed under wraps. It was a secret for more than a year. And it was only through the dedicated efforts of an Army photographer who was on the scene, Ron Haberle, Ron Reidenauer, who I mentioned earlier, who wasn't at My Lai that day but served with many of the men who were. And when he heard about this, he vowed that he would make it public, that he would make sure the word got out on it. And because of Ron's persistence, there was an investigation that was started, and that investigation tipped off Seymour Hersh, who's still breaking stories today for The New Yorker and other publications. And Cy Hersh got a hold of this, and he's the one who put it in the papers.
And Lieutenant William Calley was seen as the person who was – he was the person who was tried. He and the Captain Medina, they were the ones that were focused on. Was that fair?
Well, Calley was the only person convicted. He certainly had no shortage of blood on his hands. But to make it seem as if one man could kill more than 500 people, it's ludicrous. Calley just happened to be the lowest level officer who the military could hang this on, and they put it on his shoulders. He certainly killed a lot of people there, but there were dozens of other men who killed.
You have a chapter here in The Butcher of the Delta, and it says when Record asked, he was the person investigating it, Record?
No, he was Jeffrey Record was a military advisor on the scene who witnessed some of this.
When Record asked how the pilots could be certain of the status of the people below, these are pilots that are flying over paddy fields, he was told that U.S. forces shot anyone who tried to run from a helicopter because it was a sure sign that they were enemy fighters. Is that the kind of policies that Americans were operating under?
Yeah, this is they used a euphemism for it, evasive action. So anyone who ran was presumed to be the enemy and could be fired upon. But of course, it's very hard to stand still if there's a helicopter bearing down on you, firing its machine gun. You're apt to run. But this was seen as a way to make it easy to fire on civilians there. Even those who stood still, they said that they were possibly well-disciplined VC. This was a euphemism that was used, Vietnamese communists, and they would be fired upon as well.
Nick Turson, at the beginning of this book, you have blurbs from many, many authors. And Tim O'Brien, who wrote The Things They Carried, a great book about Vietnam. This book is an overdue and powerfully detailed account of widespread war crimes, homicide, torture, mutilation, and rape committed by American soldiers over the course of our military engagement in Vietnam. What do I do with that information as a person in America all these years later?
Well, what I was trying to bring out in writing this book, one, is that as I came to know it, the signature aspect of the war was Vietnamese civilian suffering. And I hope that there are still things people can take away from it today. You know, modern warfare no longer affects the combatants predominantly. It's civilians who suffer most during war. And I really wanted to get this this message across for the Vietnam literature, because it's not there in most of the books. The civilian side of the story is left out. And I hope that people can look at this book and then think about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the smaller drone wars we have now in Yemen and Somalia and Pakistan, and think about what those wars mean for civilians.
You want this book to be a witness for the Vietnamese who have been killed and for the soldiers who took part. Who's Jamie Henry?
Jamie's a veteran who, he really changed my life. The phrase "kill anything that moves" was a phrase that Jamie heard. When he was in Vietnam, he saw a litany of atrocities take place, the worst of them being on February 8th, 1968. He had just taken a seat and started smoking a cigarette. His unit had gone into a village, and he heard his lieutenant over the radio. So they rounded up 19 women and children. And the lieutenant asked the captain, the commanding officer, what to do with them. And this West Point trained captain said, you know that the order that came down from higher headquarters this morning, kill anything that moves. Jamie heard this. He jumped up and made his way towards the captain. He wanted to intervene, try and stop this. But what happened was he arrived on the scene just in time to see five men open up on full automatic with their M16 rifles and kill those 19 women and children. He told me that 30 seconds after he witnessed that, he vowed that he would make it public. Jamie came back to the U.S. He went to an Army lawyer and told him about it. This lawyer said, there are a million ways that the Army can make you disappear. You better keep quiet about it till you get out of the military. Jamie went and saw an Army criminal investigator, and this man threatened him. He wrote to two congressmen, and neither of them wrote him back. But Jamie kept at it. He went public. He wrote an article. He went on the radio, spoke out at public forums, but he just could never get any traction on it. Unbeknownst to him, the Army actually looked into his allegations. They corroborated everything that he said. They found numerous other crimes that the unit had committed that Jamie hadn't seen. They determined that somewhere around 20 individuals could be charged with crimes, including that West Point trained captain, the company commander. But they never took action against any of them, and they buried these records away. It wasn't until almost 40 years later, when I arrived on his doorstep carrying several phone book-sized stacks of records, that Jamie had any idea that the military had investigated his claims and had corroborated all of them. When he had spoken out about this, people had said that he was a liar. Some said that he was a fake veteran, that he'd never served. So, I mean, it took 40 years for Jamie to have some validation there. And when I went to him, I eventually put his story in the newspaper, in the LA Times. And he had a little trepidation about it. You know, he was worried about revisiting this all these years later. But eventually he said, you know, if this is the right thing to do then it's right now, and people need to know this. And, he's always been a hero to me.
He's dead. He passed away.
He did about 2 years ago. He succumbed to cancers that are linked with Agent Orange. And, it came upon him all of a sudden. It was a tragic blow.
You wrote that quite a few veterans had told you, this was in the afterword to this paperback edition, that kill anything that moves had provided them with long-sought validation. So more veterans than just Jamie have talked to you about what they saw and what they had tried to report?
Yeah, I had interviewed hundreds of veterans in preparing this book. And then, you know, I spent over a decade tracking them down. Once the book was published, I had so many more contact me through letters, emails, Facebook messages. And there were so many who said that this is the war as I saw it. And it wasn't a shock to me because, you know, most of this book comes from veterans. It's the testimony of veterans. But there were men who said that they weren't ever able to talk about this with their friends. It wasn't something that they would ever bring up to their family. But the book provided a way to grapple with these memories that they've been wrestling with for the last 40 years. It provided a space for conversation and a means for them to come to grips with what they'd seen and in some cases what they'd done.
You also say, though, of all the research you'd done, very few had spoken out about what they'd seen. A lot of these people didn't speak out. Why? Did they believe that what they had done was justified in the fog of war?
There certainly were many veterans that I talked to over the years who believed that they'd done as right. There's one man that always sticks out in my mind. I had read his confessions to conducting interrogations that were filled with torture. Electrical torture, water torture, what we now call waterboarding, the beating of prisoners. And I asked him about this, and he said that he thought it was correct at the time, and he still thought so today. He said if I was put in a Vietnam-type situation again, I would do the same things. He thought it helped the country. It was for the good of the country. He was unrepentant about it. But, there were many more men who had, over the years, you know, thought differently about what they'd done. There's another veteran who sticks in my mind. We had talked for 4 to 5 hours on the phone. It was a marathon session. He had a booming laugh, very jovial. And then he quieted down, and he said, I want to tell you a story. And he told me about going into a village and they were burning it down. He said this was standard operating procedure for the unit. What they did, many units did this. They burned the whole village down. And he said there was this GI and a woman came up and she was grabbing on his sleeve and screaming at him, and obviously because her home and all her possessions were going up in flames. And he said that the soldier pushed her off and she came back and he pushed her again. This went on a few times. And finally, he took his M16, took the butt of the rifle and hit her squarely in the nose, broke her nose. He said there was blood everywhere. She was screaming. And the GI walked away laughing. And he said, I guess you know where this is going. He said, that GI was me. He said, at the time, I didn't think anything of it. I was able to walk away laughing. I didn't think about it. And he said, but in the decades since, that's all I can think about. He said, I blocked out a lot of my memories. I think I did worse things in Vietnam, but he said, I can't get this memory out of my head. And for a lot of the veterans that I talked to, you know, they were aghast at what their 19-year-old selves had done, and they've been paying for it ever since.
Nick Turse is a writer and a journalist. His book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.